My daughter is 7 years old. I cover personal finance for a living, so I feel a certain pressure to walk the talk when it comes to kids and money. I am pretty vested, both personally and professionally, in this next interview. Ron Lieber is a columnist for the New York Times and the author of The Opposite of Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. Hello there, Ron.
Hello.
You are joining us from Brooklyn, New York. I hope having a bit of summer vacation with your kids, yes?
It is going to happen if it kills us. Work is trying to get in the way. My wife works at the Times as well. But we are definitely going to get away together for a whole 9 days later in the month.
Wow, awesome. I hope you talk about everything other than money during those 9 days, unless you have to like budget for ice cream cones and things like that. I want to start with this anecdote from your three-year-old daughter. She asked you a big question. Why don't we have a summer house? She was three. You say she was three. What do you say to that?
I said absolutely nothing. I was stunned into silence there in the front seat of the car when she sprung forth from the back with that question. Apropos of nothing, it literally came out of nowhere. We were not contemplating buying a second home. We could not afford one. We cannot afford one now. So we really had no idea where it came from. And my wife, of course, thought this was hysterical, right? It's like I played Dr. Money in the newspaper every single weekend, and I had no idea what to say to this kid, but I knew it was important, right? She had sensed that there were other people in the world who had things that she did not have, and she wasn't sure how she felt about that or how that came to pass, and she expected her parents to have an answer.
With the benefit of time, what would your answer be today if that same three-year-old asked you that question?
I say, Tali, that's a really great question. Why do you ask?
Well, that's good. That's good. Put it back to her. I love it.
Tactic, first of all, right? So it gives me a chance to kind of catch my breath, think about, where on earth this might be coming from, but also give her an opportunity to explain, right? Because, it's not totally unreasonable that a three-year-old might come to understand what a summer house is, but I actually had no idea where she got the idea from. And, maybe she thought it was a crazy notion, right? There are some kids, some very young kids, who examine their parent or their parents and their spending habits perhaps their affluence or what the kids perceive to be extravagance and find it wanting, right? Mm-hmm. They might find that, having a second home or having an extra bedroom even is wasteful when there are people who do not have homes themselves. So maybe that's where she was going with it. I didn't know, but at the time I didn't think to ask, but that's probably how I would handle it now.
I love the title of the book, The Opposite of Spoiled. What does that look like? What does that phrase connote for you?
Well, this all got started for me when I kept hearing from parents who were reading some of the columns that I was writing for the Times, and they saw some of the questions that I was posing to readers that I had heard from either my own daughter or from other older kids, the questions that they were having about money. And these parents were saying to me, Ron, there's a lot of conversation in our communities right now about inequality, and we were wondering if you could give us some ideas about how to talk about this out loud with, mixed social class groupings, or maybe you could come lead a conversation. And I thought, wow, well, that's interesting. If I had to figure out for myself, what do all these people have in common, right? The one thing I knew for sure is that nobody wants to raise a spoiled child. Mm. That's kind of where we come from, right? The shared sense that we don't want our kids to be entitled. So if that's the case, and everybody seems to sort of know a spoiled child when they see one, well, what's the opposite of spoiled, right? Because that's what we're all trying to solve for. That's what we're all trying to achieve, to produce, to create an unspoiled child, right? So then I had to make this list for myself of all the values and virtues and character traits that add up to the kind of decent and, grounded little humans that we all want to push out into the world someday. And as I began to assemble that list for myself, the profile of the unspoiled child began to take shape. right? Modesty, prudence, thrift, generosity, graciousness, curiosity, a sense of perspective, patience, perseverance.
Sounds right? like a heroine in a Bronte sister's book or something like that.
Something like that.
Something right? like that. Yes. I mean, my God, it's 2017 and prudence and modesty. How exciting in an era of Instagram.
Right. You know, I mean, these are kind of classic values. And, you know, no matter where you fall on the political spectrum, you know, these are traits that I just think everyone can agree on. Right. So you sort of tick off that list. And pretty soon you realize that you can actually teach those things. You can impress those values on your kids with all sorts of conversations about money. There's a direct connection between talking about money and teaching kids these and other values. And once I had that sorted out, I began to understand what the opposite of spoiled is and could be.
You and I are totally on the same page on the value of conversation. And I would bet we're on the same page about how parents can be a little, I don't know, nuts or neurotic about money themselves and sometimes bring that into the conversation or the lack of willingness to have the conversation because they're neurotic and nuts about money. How do you address that?
Sure. So I agree with you, and I think we should all stop, you know, before we even begin to try to have these conversations with our kids, we all ought to stop and sort of take a deep look inside of ourselves to think about what sort of stuff we might have inherited from our own parents, right? And this is a, you know, good conversation to have with a spouse or a partner if you have one, if you've never had this conversation before, right? Where you sort of self-diagnose and then diagnose in others what it was that you kind of picked up from your parent or parents about, you know, their neuroses around money, or maybe they had perfectly healthy attitudes about it. Who knows? Mm-hmm. Very few of us do, but some people are lucky enough to develop those, right? So what did you inherit from your parents? How does that affect your own mental outlook on money conversations? What are you trying to tack against or do differently than what they did? And then once you have your own head on straight, only then can you begin to think about, you know, how you want to have these conversations with your kid. But, you know, it's pretty good to kind of get inside your own head and work this stuff out first.
What are some of the big topics that we should think about weaving in, and when does that weaving begin in your mind?
Well, I think the when happens sooner than you may think, and you do not.
Summer houses at 3 years old, I think, is a great case in point.
Well, exactly, right? You don't get to dictate when this conversation starts or, you know, in what circumstances or context it comes up, right? It may come up with, you know, other people around who you know, who you may not want to overhear your kind of live parenting on the topic. But, you know, I heard from a parent not long after the book came out, whose daughter was 2.5 and wanted to know why she went to work every day when many of the other mommies that she knew did not go to work, right? So again, you know, you don't get to decide when these conversations happen, and you don't get to decide what the topics are. Your kids and their curiosity is going to dictate that. So given that they are trying to sort this stuff out sooner than we may think, you know, we have to be ready at the earliest possible moments. So, you know, I get that a lot of this is abstract for, you know, a 2 or 3 year old, but, you know, starting around the time that kids start losing their teeth. You know, if there's a tooth fairy who shows up at your house and that tooth fairy happens to bring money, you know, that may be a good time to start the conversation about, you know, how we save our money and how we spend it and, you know, when and how we give it away to people who might need it more than we do. And then you're off and running.
When do you start talking about specific numbers? I mean, obviously, there's so much of learning that occurs that doesn't require numbers. You can talk about lots of things without numbers. But at some point, you may want to introduce the cost of a house, what the salary is coming in, how much the mortgage is, how much the electricity is. How do you start in engaging your kids in those, in that level of specificity, and in what context?
Well, you know, I think when they're in the single digit ages, they and you are limited by, you know, the extent of their math knowledge, right? You know, their addition, subtraction, multiplication skills, you know, those numbers only go so high.
Right. And $100 seems like an infinite amount. You can't even imagine paying, you know, $800,000 for a place to live.
Well, exactly, right? But the big idea here is that we want to introduce them to ever larger numbers once they get used to the smaller ones, right? So you're, you know, graduating from, you know, a piece of candy or an ice cream cone to the toy that they may want, to the first bicycle, to the first phone, to the first car, to the college education. You're kind of graduating from, you know, the two digit numbers to the three, to the four, to the five. And, you know, if you're unlucky enough to live down here in the United States, you're looking at six figures for college. So that's kind of how it goes, and it's a progression over 15 or 20 years, and you know, all along the way, you're slowly introducing them to the aspects of adult life that, you know, correspond with those two and three and four figure numbers. But if we're giving them practice all along, it's not such a stretch to you know, once they're in 10 or 12 or 14, say, begin to introduce them to the, you know, three and four figure numbers that may dictate our own, you know, monthly budgets as adults.
Right. And then they can go Instagram your salary to all of their friends because you've disclosed it to them.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, right? Because the thing that many parents worry about the most when it comes to transparency and disclosure is that the kids will blab. But let's be realistic about how much they know and how much they can find out, right? I mean, I was one of those kids who looked up their parents' tax returns when they were in middle school. I literally went into the filing cabinet and grabbed it because I was trying to make sense of all of the fighting about money that was going on right in my household, right? You know, they can look up and figure out all sorts of things. They will be into your bills. They will be looking over your shoulders. They will be, you know, hacking their way into your phones. They're going to know more than you think. So, you know, I think maybe the better conversation to have with them is to say, look, you know, you may want to know, say, what our salaries are. And we absolutely want to give you that information. In fact, we think you are entitled to it because as a, you know, 16 or 17 or 18-year-old who's going to need to make some decisions about what they study and what they might want to do, it's going to be important for you to know what we earned that allowed you to have whatever standard of living that you enjoy now. But you should know, if you share that information on social media or with your friends, it's just going to sound like bragging and you're going to sound like a jerk.
Right.
And that information doesn't have much, you know, currency or value out there. A lot of the people that we know are a lot like us and they're just not going to care about what we have and what we make. So please keep that information to yourself.
Abby has a four-compartment piggy bank, which I love, but one of the compartments is donating, and she has decided she doesn't want to donate money anymore. She wants to keep it all for herself. So that will be like a lesson in progress. What would you do with that?
Here's how I would deal with that one. Every single family, if you stop and think about it, has their own history of having been helped itself. So my family's history goes something like this, right? My mom is a survivor of premenopausal breast cancer. She and her friends got together when another friend of theirs was not so lucky and did not survive, and put together a breast cancer fundraising organization that now has raised over $25 million
wow.
over the last 30 years, right? So I got to have a mom because people who were generous before she came down with the disease, you know, donated money so that the treatment that she got back in 1979 at Northwestern University was good enough to allow her to continue staying alive, right? My wife, her grandmother is a Holocaust survivor, right? Literally ran across Europe away from Hitler and his goons. So there's a reason why we have a particular interest in philanthropic interest in our household in refugees. I was a scholarship kid all through middle school, high school, and college. I only got to go to the schools that I attended because other people there had been generous before me, right? So our 11-year-old daughter, she knows all of those stories, and she understands that there is a direct connection between the way that we give and the generosity that we feel and the goodness that has been bestowed on us, right? So, you know, with a child, it might be as simple as thinking about the things that he or she enjoys doing the most and how generous people have made those things possible, whether it's a children's museum or a renovated park or a school that she attends or something like that. There's almost always a way to draw a direct line between the things that you enjoy or the mere fact that you're still alive and somebody else's generosity that you can mimic yourself.
We just have a couple minutes left, but I want to get to one other concept you've talked about, and that is artificial deprivation. I love it. Now, in talking about that, I want to acknowledge that for the people who have artificial deprivation, they have a certain economic stability. They're not living paycheck to paycheck and, you know, at the food bank every other day. But for people who do have that stability, you'd advocate that they need to create some artificial deprivation. What do you mean?
Well, I don't think you have much choice, right? I mean, if you're lucky enough to have more than average and you can get your child everything that that child needs and at least some of what they want, you probably know good and well that getting them everything they want is not going to be good for them, right? So there need to be limits. And, you know, this often comes up, right, when parents say to kids, well, we're not going to get that because I don't have the money or I can't afford it, right? If that's not true, then you're lying. Lying to kids is generally not a good idea. Mm. They will often sniff it out, right? So we need a better reason, which is that, you know, it might go something like this. We're not going to buy those things because, you know, we set a limit for ourselves that what we value this month or this season is making sure that we can go see this theater production that we've been dying to see. Or we want to make sure that we can have enough money for a vacation that we want to take in the summer. And that requires making some choices, making some trade-offs. And it'll mean you know, fewer of these smaller things that you may want to do. But it will mean that we get to do some of these big things, right? And that's going to mean having some limits.
One last tough question. I've only got about 30 seconds for it, but I've got to ask it. Parents go about the parenting job very, very differently. How do you account for different parenting values when it comes to teaching your kids about money?
Well, I think the thing that I would say about that, right, is that, you know, many kids will ask about other families and other parents and the decisions they make and the things they buy. And I think you can say at a very young age, you know what, I know it may look different and look funny and it may be something that you're jealous of, but we do not in fact know how much other families have. We know a little bit about the decisions they make, but we don't know what they borrow. We don't know why they're making the choices that they make or the pressures or constraints that they may be under. We only know about our own family, and we're going to provide you with enough information so that you understand why we make the decisions that we make, and we're going to try not to pass judgments or make assumptions about other families and what they do.
That's great. Ron, we will speak again because my kid's only 7. I still got a lot of work ahead of me. Appreciate your time.
Excellent. Thank you.
Ron Lieber is a columnist for The New York Times and the author of The Opposite of Spoiled. He joined us from Brooklyn, New York.